From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today, we'll examine and discuss the growing ecological issue of invasive species and the impact these invading pests can have on our way of life and precious ecosystems. According to an executive order signed in 1999 by then-President Bill Clinton, the United States defines an invasive species as, quote, an alien species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health, end quote. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Invasive Species Information Center says that these invading life forms can be plants, animals, and other organisms like microbes. The Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health at the University of Georgia's website says, quote, the estimated damage from invasive species worldwide totals more than $1.4 trillion or 5% of the global economy, end quote. Joining us today via Skype is my guest, Don Weber, an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. Don, what are invasive species and how much of a problem are they around the world? In other words, why should we be concerned about this issue?
Invasive species are really organisms that spread in new non-native habitats. They can be anything, animal, vegetable, insects, mollusks, vertebrates, plants, microbes, including viruses, and altogether they're a big deal. The estimated global impact, and this is just from invasive insects alone, is estimated to exceed $70 billion U.S. dollars a year in lost goods and services and $7 billion a year in increased health costs, and some of that's from insects that vector disease.
So we're basically talking about invasive plants, insects, sea life, reptiles, and animals, pretty much all life forms.
Yes, all life forms can be invasive, and it's basically defined as new, non-native organisms in new environments. And in terms of human interests, it's defined as ones that jeopardize public health, agriculture, or natural habitats, and as a result of that, often have big economic impacts on humans around the world.
Are these forms of life also considered to be invasive in their home areas? And what differentiates...
Many of them aren't. And that's an interesting thing, and it also sometimes makes it a little harder to foresee what might happen when they get into a new environment. An example that I've worked on is the brown marmorated stink bug. Well, in East Asia, it's noticeable. It's kind of considered a minor pest, not a huge problem. When it was accidentally introduced to North America and later to Europe and even the Caucasus area, the brown marmorated stink bug didn't have any of its natural enemies, which is one of the things suppressing it in the native Asian range. And suddenly it was a much bigger pest. So some are and some aren't. Some we don't even know where they came from originally. So an example of one that is a pest in its native area is a very big impact now in Africa and Asia. It's called the fall armyworm. And in the Americas, where it's native, it is considered a major pest of maize or corn. So there's no set rule, but often it's less a problem in the native area where it came from.
Don, can you tell me the difference between an invasive species and a nuisance species?
Well, that involves kind of related to my answer to the previous question, which some native species are nuisances. For example, there are areas where the mosquitoes are native and they bite humans and they transmit disease and pathogens to humans. And that's an example of that. Basically, there are also exotic or non-native insects and other organisms which are planted, for instance, as crops or maybe as ornamental plants or enjoyed as pets, and they don't end up being invasive, meaning that they don't move into natural habitats and they don't threaten the native flora and fauna. So when we speak of invasive species, it's what's non-native that's bothering us. Just like a weed is a plant in the wrong place, an invasive species is more of a general term for something that's established and moved in and has negative impacts in its new habitats.
Are all non-native species, other words, exotic plant or animal life, considered to be invasive?
No, that's definitely not true. And in fact, the best example is our crop plants. For instance, the tomato, which is native to the Americas, and for that matter, the potato, which is fairly closely related to tomato, has spread throughout the world as both of them essential and very tasty crop plants. And they do not tend to be invasive. So it's more of a judgment of what's the impact. In this case, non-native plants have a very beneficial impact on people's agricultural productivity and nutrition.
Don, how long has this been an issue? How long has invasive species been a problem for those of us on planet Earth? And is it getting better or worse?
Well, I think we could say it dates from probably the beginning of history, or at least the beginning of when people started moving around a lot. Moving plants and animals, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. Certainly one of the biggest early examples is the movement of European people to the Americas and bringing a lot of their own human diseases and infecting, unfortunately, those Native Americans who had not been previously exposed to them. So it dates back centuries at least. Of course, we have to put this in a bigger context. Like we do evolution, we say, you know, this is species have been invading new habitats, even new continents over the course of millennia. What's happened recently because of a lot of human movement is that the whole process has sped up, and therefore the ability of the natural environment to adjust to those invasions has been degraded because these invasions happen so quickly. And sometimes groups of invasive species work, it happens together, to aggravate or accentuate the impacts of others. There's examples, though, and I'll give one. The cattle egret, which is this white bird that you often see perched on the backs of grazing animals, originally from Africa, within recent history, and a big storm brought some of them over to South America, where they became established and, in fact, spread even to North America. And they're not considered harmful. So in answer to your question, it's more a matter of quantity, and it's increased so much, though, in recent years. And especially with air travel and world trade, there's an added number of what we call pathways of invasion that make it much more both abundant and impactful.
Don, let's examine those pathways. I'm curious, how do these species get to areas where they become a problem? Are they because of an accidental incident, or could it be someone's idea of treating another problem?
Well, there's examples both of accidental and purposeful introductions. Along the ways of accidental introductions, we think of the movement of live plants, produce, wood packaging materials, bulk materials like stones and other construction materials, tires, including old tires, people, their pets, and livestock. So it's a broad variety of pathways, many times quarantine or preventative approaches to try and prevent spread of invasive species are targeted against some of the most likely. And some of those are live plants, wood packaging material, and people themselves bringing things on purpose. So you mentioned on purpose, the pet trade, unfortunately, is responsible for some, not the pet trade itself, but people who have pets, maybe some of the pet trade, but introducing naively, I think, not necessarily intending for harm to come, but thinking, wow, this would be great to have geckos on this island. And all of a sudden, you've got, you know, several thousand geckos instead of the two that started it. So nowadays, now in the past, there have been some intentional introductions in connection with what people hope would be biological control and controlling a pest that was already there. And one of the most notorious examples of this was introduction of the cane toad from South America into Australia to control some beetle grubs in sugarcane. Well, it was a dumb idea then, and it's a way dumber idea now. And biological control, when we talk about introduction biocontrol of natural enemies, is nowadays done very carefully. So it's screened for negative effects, And if anything's not specific and going to go to another organism, that is a natural enemy potentially attacking a non-target or beneficial or crop organism, that's not allowed. So it's a variety of accidental, purposeful pathways.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're examining the growing ecological issue of invasive species and the impact these invading pests can have on our way of life and our precious ecosystems. Don Weber, who joins me today via Skype, is my guest. Don is an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. Don, let's talk about some of the more troublesome invasive species and where they're causing problems. Colombia has a problem with an aggressive hippo population, and the hippopotamus is native to sub-Saharan Africa. How did they become an issue in South America?
Well, that's a kind of a unique story. The hippopotami, plural of hippopotamus, that now are in Colombia, South America, they were originally part of an illegal zoo by the drug lord Pablo Escobar. And when he was killed years ago in a firefight with the government agents there, he left this zoo, and the four hippopotami that were in the zoo were not taken into captivity. They were allowed to go free, and they're now, as I understand it, about 80 or maybe more now in that river basin, which is the Magdalena, Rio Magdalena in Colombia. And the issue is twofold, really. One is people who live in sub-Saharan Africa are very well aware of this, that the hippopotamus is actually the animal responsible for the most human deaths by large predators, not lions, elephants, etc. So they're a dangerous animal when they're mature. And maybe more important in terms of the impact on the whole ecosystem, they graze a huge amount of vegetation, and then their waste in the river can promote blue-green algae, what is sometimes called red tide when it's in the marine system, but an excess of nutrients that could be really damaging to the river ecosystem, including fish and other resources that people use. So, yeah, the people maybe laugh about the hippopotamus and Pablo Escobar's former zoo, but it's kind of a spectacular example of invasive species that were brought in, I guess you could say, as part of the pet trade. Some people are fond of them, but people with experience with hippopotamus in Africa say, don't be fond of them. Keep your distance.
This is a species that you had spoke about a little earlier, the fall army worm. It's native to the Americas, and I understand that this worm has recently become a source of havoc in Africa and Asia. Tell us a little more about this insect and how it got to non-native territory and what kind of problems it's causing in Africa and Asia.
Well, yeah, it's become a near global pest in the course of only about 5 years. It's a very strong flying migratory moth. And of course, the stage, the caterpillar or worm, fall army worm, that does the damage is the one that eats maize and many other crops. It's native to South America, Central America, and parts of North America. In fact, in the past, I've worked on that pest in northeastern United States on maize, sweet corn, actually. But recently, around 2015, it showed up in West Africa, and right away people knew it was an issue because it's the major pest of maize in Central and South America and feeds very heavily on the what we call the whorl stage, or before the tassels come out of the corn, and therefore has a big impact on yield. And then within a couple years, it spread to South Asia and East Asia. So India and China, Nepal, and other countries in that region are now dealing with it. So a fall armyworm, you know, is a huge threat to productivity of maize, which is a major staple, of course, but other crops as well. So there are a number of, it's established. There's no way to really prevent it is established in Africa and Asia. The big concern is there are a lot of subsistence farmers and low-income farmers who cannot afford to treat it with pesticides or with Bacillus thuringiensis, which is BT, a very specific microbial control, but that costs money. And there are a number of academic research, overseas aid agencies working with the countries around the impacted area to try and figure out what's the best approach to manage this now. Because we're in a management phase, we cannot prevent what's happened. It's not known, as far as I know, how it reached Africa, but it could have been a natural introduction, but however it reached it, it's going to have a huge impact.
Don, another species that you spoke about a little earlier, I want to get a little more information on it because you have an interesting story about it. The brown marmorated stink bug. It's native to East Asia, but has been introduced to North America, Europe, and now Chile and the Georgia Republic. What is it? How is it thought to have spread from non-native areas? And what kind of calamity is it causing as an invasive species?
Well, the brown marmorated stink bug, and marmor is Latin for marbled, so it has kind of a marbled or mottled appearance. That's why it's called that. It's what we entomologists call a true bug. True bugs insert their mouth parts and piercing, sucking-type mouth parts. They don't chew. And in doing that, they can damage crops or inject their saliva, which is can be toxic to the crops. And also they're withdrawing food from the crop, so that's decreasing its productivity. Unfortunately, brown marmorated stink bug, which is native to East Asia, has a very, very wide range of host plants. I believe the list is up to several hundred. And it also has a somewhat like a nuisance value or nuisance status. When they overwinter, they like to overwinter in nature in rocks or hollow trees. And our houses apparently look like that. So buildings, including houses and other buildings, shelter these insects in pretty large numbers. And sometimes they get into materials that then might be moved, like pipes, tiles, etc., construction materials. And that's probably the way they were transported to both to North America and to Europe. They initially showed up in Switzerland. So brown marmorated stink bug is mainly looking like its most serious impact on crops is with fruits and nuts. You mentioned the invasion into Georgia, and in the Georgian Republic is a major source of hazelnuts, and I believe it's either the second or third leading producer in the world. And those were heavily impacted when the brown marmorated stink bug was accidentally introduced into that region. Chile as well, grows a lot of fruits. That's a big concern. That introduction apparently came from the west coast of North America. So one thing you got to know about invasive species is once they get around the world, sometimes they can be introduced from a place where they're already invading. They're not a native. And the reason might be that, in fact, for instance, on the west coast of the United States, they're much more abundant than they are, for instance, in their original native China, Japan, and Korea. So it's an interesting phenomenon we call in entomology world, we call it the bridgehead effect. So some gathering of invasive species at a high level of abundance, like we see it when many times in the first several years when they're moving in, can carry on to other regions. And in this case, it has. Georgia apparently got its infestation from Europe and Chile from North America.
Don, I understand there's an interesting story about how European starlings became a real problem here in the U.S. Can you tell us about this and how extensive the damage is being caused by them?
Well, a starling is one of a set of birds mentioned in the works of Shakespeare. And I mention that because that's the reason it was introduced to the United States back in the 19th century, well over 100 years ago. There was a group of people who admired William Shakespeare and his writings, and they decided naively that it would be nice to introduce all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare. So they set about introducing, among other things, the European starling. And they tried very hard. They introduced it to Central Park several times. And we find this ironic today because it succeeded getting established in huge numbers. Its impact largely is on native birds here in North America, where the starling will take away the cavities where it nests in old trees, in the holes in fence posts and so on. And it really drives out the native birds, including woodpeckers that are considered beneficial in terms of eating beetles, that mainly beetles that bother forest trees. So the starling is established. It's fairly abundant in Europe. Another case where it's considered in some ways in Europe somewhat of a pest. It also loves to eat fruit when it's ripe. So fruit growers are not particularly fond of starlings. So that's a great example of a purposeful introduction. We wouldn't really recognize the purpose as a good one, but somebody thought it was a good idea.
Don, I was surprised to read that the common rabbit is an invasive species that spread from Europe and North Africa to all the continents of the world except for Antarctica. I always thought rabbits were a natural species everywhere.
Well, the most spectacular of that actually is a continent you didn't mention, which is Australia. And Australia, of course, was after the Aborigines were established there, the Europeans showed up and they wanted their favorite animals from jolly old England and other places where they came from. And they brought, among other things, rabbits. And you think to yourself, well, what harm could a rabbit do? Well, if a rabbit eats all the vegetation in sight and furthermore reproduces very well, and rabbits are notorious for that, reproducing and making a lot more rabbits. So in that case, they brought along none of their native diseases or predators, and the predators in Australia were not familiar with rabbits and didn't have much impact on them. So basically, the rabbits denuded the landscape. And finally, that was an example of a spectacular biological control where they introduced a virus that quelled the rabbits. Now, that's not the only place that rabbits have gone and done some damage. In fact, I think there's a case now where they're present in the UK, and those were introduced in historical time from Europe. And people argue about whether or not they really have a place in that ecosystem. But yes, harmless things can cause harm on occasion.
And the one species I really want to talk about with you is, I understand, is responsible for wrecking ecosystems in the Florida Everglades, the Burmese python. Tell me how this snake, I understand they can grow up to 7 meters, how it became an invasive species, what damage it's doing in Florida, and what's being done to eliminate the problem.
Well, the Burmese python was kept by a number of people in Florida as a pet, and they also were kept by pet dealers as well. And as you know, Florida is subject to hurricanes, cyclones from time to time. So all those factors, including people's lack of awareness of how bad an idea it would be to release them, resulted in them being released in Peninsula or South Florida. And some were purposeful, but I think the evidence is also that they also escaped accidentally when people's houses and pet stores were ravaged during a number of hurricanes. But the story becomes then that the Burmese python basically ate up anything that was smaller than them. And as you reference, when you're 7 meters, there's most things are smaller than you. And they have cleared out a lot of the vertebrate fauna of South Florida, including raccoons, even alligators, and other predators. And it's still an open problem and a big one. They held a contest to see if they could hunt them down. There are so many, it's difficult. They're looking at attractants, and they're learning more about the Burmese python by tracking it. In other words, tagging snakes with radio collars or radio chips. And there is some hope that they can learn enough about what attracts them, because they're basically solitary except when they mate, but somehow they've got to find one another. And many times with animals, including insects and vertebrates, that involves what we call pheromones. Pheromones are odors that are produced by an individual to typically attract members of the same species. And those can be very useful in both detecting and helping to manage invasive species. Let me talk about weeds, common ragweed in Europe. It's amazing, though, that that is an example of an accidental natural enemy. The ragweed leaf beetle came in, and it's already been documented that that introduction, which was accidental into France, has reduced the ragweed. And in fact, opened the eyes of some in Europe to the fact that biological control can be a very effective method if it's carefully vetted and carefully carried out to specifically address the invasive species, in this case, common ragweed, that produces a lot of problems for people with allergies.
Don, we're just about out of time, but I want to ask you finally, what can everyday people do to stem the spread of invasive species?
Well, it's not all bad news, and I think when you learn more about this, there's several important points here. I think public education and awareness to understand that there are inherent threats to try and avoid introductions, and also the public has a very important role in recognizing and reporting these promptly so they can either be eradicated or addressed as early as possible. Because the monitoring and inspection, anything that relates to preventative approaches, and if the potential invader is present, to a rapid response, is much better and in the long run less impact than if they become established and then have to be managed and there's going to be impacts. An important thing that is less apparent to the public is research with international cooperation. So we need to know what are the potential invasive species and the ones that are already there. We need to understand their biology, what they eat, what eats them, etc. We also need to get clues from where they're native and other places where they may have invaded. How do you manage them? How do you control them? Sometimes that involves looking at the natural enemies and potentially introducing them to suppress the invasive population. And it really is something we're all in together as a planet. As you alluded to at the beginning, we need to cooperate in learning about and managing these invasive species and to try and slow their spread in such a way that we can manage them and minimize the impact on our agriculture, our health, and our natural ecosystems.
Don Weber, I want to thank you so much for taking time to bring us up to date. Tell us all about invasive species.
Well, you're welcome, Rick, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
That was Don Weber, an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. He joined our program today via Skype. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.